To Katie and Aaron for organizing this. It's great to be here. It's great to see all of you. I'm really looking forward to learning from all of the talks that we'll see in the next few days. This is a talk from the on behalf of the Dart Chemists of Penn State, although I just standing here realized that I can't call us that anymore because so many of the Dart Chemists have been seeded out into the broader world. So now we have a network of Dart Chemists, including James here, who's infiltrated PI. People in red are people I've supervised. We have undergrads, grads, postdocs. And this work, of course, happens because of my faculty member collaborators, Dongwei and Chad, as well. So, you know, in the past, I don't know, 5 or 6 years or so, I think myself and probably many of you in the room have become interested in this sort of different way of looking at dark matter, which is to say, for a long time, we've had this lovely, cute cartoon about all the ways that we search for dark matter versus direct detection, production, indirect detection. But that cartoon assumes that the most important interaction is with the standard model, right? By most important, I mean most important for us to discover dark matter, and often most important in terms of the cosmological signatures, the cosmological relevance of those parameters. However, there is another vast space of opportunities where we have a complicated dark sector, and it may be only gravity, you know, for all intents and purposes, that connects that complicated dark sector to the visible matter. And it may be that cosmologically speaking, and in terms of our ability to detect dark matter, the most important interactions are actually those within the dark sector itself. In some ways, you know, this idea is old. It's not a new idea. It's maybe the most natural thing you could think of, right? We've got the standard model. It looks like this. We've got dark matter. Why wouldn't it look something like the standard model? And there are all of these sort of intriguing, you know, broken symmetries that might suggest that there's some particle content that's sort of like ours, but, you know, not exactly like ours. So this was actually a very popular framework for many years. And you could find it in string theory, and people worked hard to, in fact, even talk about structures in that scenario. I think that idea went a little bit under the radar, right? We have some other great ideas put forth by some great ideas for physics beyond the standard model. But nonetheless, this remains a really interesting space to look in. And what's nice about it is we really can focus on what are the gravitational signatures of dark matter microphysics. On large scales, of course, we know a lot about how that works. We have these very clean large-scale structure probes where physics is very linear, things are very simple, and that's what's taught us a lot about what we know dark matter is as opposed to what it isn't. And I'm sure you're all well aware that we've got this fabulous, fascinating, complex space then where things start to get complicated and messy, right? Between the stuff that's really clean and the area where there are hints that maybe structure isn't doing exactly what it should do if it was only cold dark matter, but we don't know because it's super complex because you have all of this complicated baryonic physics, energy transfer processes as well. So this is tantalizing, but it's not clear. And it, you know, I don't think it's quite obvious yet how this whole space is going to resolve, either from theory or from data. What we've been interested in recently is that if you go to even smaller scales, you have a probe of dark matter microphysics that, again, in some sense is clean, in the sense that it's either there or it's not. You either see a dark, novel, compact object, or you don't. You know, the details of what those are, like how many, what is their mass spectrum, that, of course, is complicated again. But the signature itself, you're not going to confuse that with a baryonic process. So we've been interested in compact objects that can be produced by a different set of microphysics than what we've got in the standard model. And that have sort of, you know, I hate this word, but I'm going to say it here once anyway, the smoking gun signature of something that's not standard model. I won't say it again. Okay. And of course, the reason this is especially interesting now is that we have, for the past now several years, gravity-only probes of those compact objects, right? So we have now, I think, 90 things are in the O3 catalog. 90 mergers of compact objects are in the O3 catalog. This is the standard plot showing what LIGO has seen, LIGO Virgo Calgra, together with what's been detected electromagnetically in terms of neutron stars and black holes. And of course, the O4A run finished in late January, so we've got a bunch of new stuff coming out from that as well. So what we were interested in, you know, again, talking to my colleague Chad Hanna, who works on LIGO, you know, what can we do that's really novel with this data set? And we got interested in a very simple model of dark matter. It's been around for a long time, atomic dark matter, where basically you have two fundamental fermions, oppositely charged, some dark U1, right, dark electromagnetism. This is a proton in the sense that it's a fermion, it's not composite, there's no QCD, there's nothing complex in this model. Proton is simple. We have a massless photon, and we have some coupling constant. The reason this model is wonderful for this exploration, two things. One is that you get interesting black hole masses, potentially, right? And the first reason for that is just the scaling of the Chandrasekhar limit with the mass of the heavier fermion. Right, Chandrasekhar limit is something around a solar mass, goes down as the mass of that heavy fermion goes up. So you give me a model with a heavier fermion, which, you know, there's indications from data that fermion should be heavier, right? We want small sigma over m. You give me a heavier fermion, I can give you a subsolar mass black hole. Now, of course, that's a statement about, you know, just a limit that exists in sort of a perfectly cold ideal gas. You have to form those things. But what's great about this model is you can form them in a process that's analogous to POP3 star formation because you have available to you all the many complex cooling channels that are in hydrogen, atomic and molecular hydrogen. So this is a model where, in principle, you know you can form these black holes dynamically, right? And I say no, right? In principle, you can form them dynamically, and they can have masses that are interesting. And although it's not often shown on plots from LIGO Virgo Chagra, to my great chagrin, they have a lot of power below a solar mass. So you often see plots that cut off at a solar mass when you see predictions for various instruments and future detections. However, the sensitivity curves, this is now advanced LIGO where it was when we wrote the first paper. The design sensitivity advanced LIGO is this sort of greenish one. And something like Einstein telescope, a far future detection, is there in dark blue. What this is showing is as a function of the chirp mass of the binary, right? So that's this combination of the masses of the objects that's sort of most detectable by LIGO. In solar masses, here's one, it's showing you the distance out to which LIGO can confidently detect such a merger in megaparsecs. So, you know, by the time you get to something like Einstein telescope, you're out to the coma cluster for things that are 0.1 solar masses. So there's a non-trivial volume here where the current instruments and the future instruments can actually detect mergers. And of course, in the standard model of particle physics and astrophysics, that space is empty. So you see something that's a beautiful detection possibility. So we did a first estimate of this now some years ago. Donghui Zhang and his student Henry, basically, as James likes to say, I'm going to use your line, James, it's so good. We copied the POP3 star kids' homework. We did basically what you would do if you do POP3 stars, except sort of rescaling things by the parameters of the dark matter model. And we had a prediction that if, you know, we estimated something like 10 to the minus 5 of the dark matter is able to cool and collapse into black holes made of dark matter, then these are the numbers of events that LIGO should see per year as a function of, say, the mass of the heavier fermion. There's a lot of detail here. But the only point I want to point out on this slide is that these are numbers that are reachable, right? You see one event per year, certainly 22 events per year, you know something about the dark matter. The other thing that's actually good is that it's actually a pretty powerful constraint on the fraction of dark matter that can cool, which means this is a different kind of constraint than we have from all the sort of larger scale, large and medium scale structure observations that constrains for you the amount of dissipation in the dark matter model. So it's a powerful constraint, a new kind of constraint, and it also has big potential for detectability. And I should say, I think we're going to hear examples from several other groups here. Nico, I don't know, someone from Joe's group is here, I think. Yeah, great. talking about other examples that are simpler than this, but where you can also get this black hole formation, compact object formation. OK. So what we've been doing are a few things. One thing is we can go out and just do the subsolar mass search. So until 04, this had to be done as a completely separate search. It's very expensive. You need a lot of templates to cover the subsolar part of the parameter space. So basically, you know, it's like a million templates for the standard search. It's another million templates or so for the subsolar search between about masses of 0.2 and 1. And it's computationally intensive because these things are small. They spend a lot of time in the band, in the LIGO bands, right? So there's just a lot of space you have to do to compute the overlap there. So this is an expensive search. And so it's been run in 003 for black hole masses between about 0.2 and 10, some ratio of masses in the merger, some spin parameter space. But the long story short is that there's no detection. So this is a constraint on the fraction of dark matter in dark black holes. But I think it's only starting to get into the regime that's interesting, right? And just sort of back of the envelope, you know, there's a tiny fraction of standard model in black holes. We know that whatever dark matter is doing, it has to be somewhat overall less strongly interacting than the standard model. But there's more dark matter. So you don't expect the ratio, the maximum amount of stuff that's in compact objects by this mechanism to be all that different than the standard model. So a fraction of stuff in the standard model is in black holes, right? Definitely well below sub percent, 0.1%, something like that. Somebody probably knows better than I do that number, but it's small. So this hitting this 10 to the minus 5 threshold is about to be expected for just starting to probe these models, I think. OK, I want to say just a little bit about a test case that we did to get ready for what we would learn if we had a detection. This test case comes from this particular object, 190425, which is a merger that's classified by LIGO as a neutron star binary, probably, or a light black hole. The thing about this is it's a little weird. Now, I say a little weird. We have kind of small number statistics, right? These are all of the this dashed curve there are the binary neutron stars detected in the galaxy, right, electromagnetically. Oops, what happened? No. OK. What happened?
That's,
I have no idea. God's in the sky. It's the first time my prayers were answered like so quickly. Okay, thanks, gods. So basically, you know, this is just a plot from the LIGO Virgo collaboration paper that discusses this event, just pointing out that it's rather unusual in terms of the mass distribution. Okay, I don't know. Maybe that's no big deal. On the other hand, it's an interesting test case to take to say, okay, let's suppose we know for sure that this is a dark black hole. What does that tell us about the rest of the world? So what we did in a paper that was led by Divya Singh, a student that's graduating this year at Penn State, was basically to say, well, let's say we know for sure this one's a dark black hole. We have no idea. We're going to flip a coin about the other ones, except for this purple one. Just look at the blue curve for a second. Flip a coin about the other ones, because we don't know, and ask what this says about the model. So, of course, when you do that, the rate constraints from LIGO turn into a limit on the source population that's going into the mergers. And the one thing that's extremely clear is what is the mass limit of that distribution, right? And that basically is driven, again, by the mass of that one event. So no surprise. But the first thing that you learn is that if that really was a dark black hole, you would have a confident statement that basically the Chandrasekhar limit of the dark matter is lower than it is for the standard model, which tells you pretty much that fermion, that heavy fermion, is heavier than the proton. With some modeling, you could do better, right? Because back to the story about the cooling, these black holes are not forming at the Chandrasekhar limit, most likely. They're forming based on the chemistry of the gas. So if you model well the chemistry of the gas, what's the coldest temperature the gas can cool to? What's the scale that the gas fragments? You know, how much then accretes to form some object for you? What you're actually constraining is something more interesting, which is sort of that lowest limit, lowest temperature the gas can cool to, which in this model is set basically by the molecular physics. And so if you take a very simple argument about the lowest gap of the transition for the molecule, the dark molecule, then what you're really constraining is some combination of the coupling constants and the parameters. So you're getting microphysics. I go through this just to say you really are getting microphysics, right, from a gravity-only detection of this object. And I think the other thing this does is it kind of repositions our space of how we constrain dark matter models, right? So we're all familiar with the plot where you have like the neutron cross section, right? The LZ type plots, right? It's a function of, and then it's a function of energy or mass. We're all familiar with the velocity dependent cross sections for SIDM. For these types of more complicated models, what you're really constraining is a cooling curve, the dissipation rate as a function of temperature. So for example, if you say we absolutely have a dark black hole, you had sufficient cooling in some regime to form a black hole, and that gives you one point that your cooling curve needs to pass through. So in this plot, that's that blue region up there. On the other hand, you say, oh, but we've got the Bullitt cluster. That gives us a constraint on the total energy loss or dissipation in this dark matter. That gives you another point at a very different temperature regime, right? Different type of halo space, cluster versus halo, early time halo, where you put a constraint that your cooling curve has to pass through. So for any particular model, you do a whole bunch of work, right, to get a cooling curve. But the point is that you just have to fit it between these different points. So one thing we are trying to understand better is how do you put more points on this plot that actually have small error bars, because it's easy to put plots that have really big error bars. How do you get small error bars so that what you're starting to do is to constrain a cooling function for a dissipative dark matter model? OK. Let me just finish this little section by saying the outlook for this type of search is really good. If you look at projections, recent projections for, you know, various instruments that are sort of on the horizon in the sense that people are spending a lot of time to develop careful science cases to start to get these things funded. And things like, you know, A plus and A sharp for advanced LIGO that have a good probability of getting funded, I think, you can see that those sensitivity curves are coming way down, close to what I quoted for Einstein telescope at the beginning. You know, maybe not all the way down, but we'll get there. So there's a huge space here to continue to look for novel compact objects. I've emphasized subsolar mass black holes. That's obviously not the only possibility. For one thing, the distribution of these things potentially overlaps, right, with the non-subsolar mass region. You can talk about dark white dwarfs. You can talk about dark neutron stars. There are all kinds of other objects that have very clean, kind of distinct signatures once you start doing not only the mass spectrum, but also things like compactness, tidal deformability. So this is just a really rich area for these complex dark matter models to try to work in. OK, good. So Aaron's going to keep me on time, but hopefully I'll be OK. OK, great. I think that's about right. So what we've been doing in our group since then is a lot of stuff to go from the microphysics to predictions, more refined predictions for this phenomena. And on the other hand, trying to do more sophisticated analysis between what data is out there and constraints on populations, right? this way is not too hard in the sense that I can give you some population and we can do lots of fun stuff with the data analysis. This way is really hard. I don't think any of you, I certainly wouldn't believe myself if I gave you a predicted mass distribution for dark black holes, because have you seen the predictions for standard model black holes, right? And that's a lot of work, so I'm not gonna do that. On the other hand, it's really tantalizing to do better at understanding the predictions of these models overall for the entire space of structure formation, right? And so what we're trying to do is just move a little bit forward in this space so that we know if models are consistent with existing constraints, what potential interesting signatures they have on the scales where people have explored interesting ideas for self-interacting dark matter, so that then when we do this side and we run the model analysis, you know, we basically know if the space is going to be consistent with what matches the rest of the data.
So you understand the one from black holes, right? Normal.
No, right, that's what I'm saying, yeah. I usually show this slide where you have the beautiful table, right, of all the predictions.
Yes.
And it's all, right, I mean, granted, there's a lot more physics there, but you know, I don't think that I'm gonna have the resolution or the physics knowledge to give you an accurate prediction of this. But what I can do is give you rough consistency of this given all the other data, and then if we have a detection here, that helps us fill out the space. Yeah, please, actually interrupt me anytime, because I don't know, I know it's 8:30, but okay. Maybe it's 9 by now, okay. So I'm gonna tell you a little bit about what we've been doing in this space most recently. So, you know, there's lots of work on mirror dark matter, lots of work on complex dark sectors, there's lots of work on the atomic dark matter model, so lots of stuff already exists. However, until recently, not a lot was known about the molecular physics, and the molecular physics is really key for, you know, understanding this full story that I'm telling you about the cooling that happens in the center of galaxies. And, you know, we know that because of all the hard work that people have done in early star formation, especially POP3 star formation, that really what happens, to determine the formation of the first stars depends on, again, how this gas breaks up, how it fragments, and that depends on the temperature that the gas can reach. And for the standard model, there's a really big difference between what happens with atomic cooling and what happens with molecular cooling. So molecular cooling is key. Now, you can all write down this problem. However, it's very difficult to solve. Fortunately, we have dimensional analysis and graduate students. So your heroes of this story are James in the room and Michael, who's now also graduated. And what they did primarily is to just rescale what's known for standard model hydrogen as a function of the mass of the light fermion, mass of the heavy fermion, and the coupling constant, the electromagnetic constant. It's not too hard to get some of the basic molecular properties. That's fine, you can do that. And you know, the way we're doing this whole procedure is to basically take the leading order calculation of these quantities, rescale them. The general principle here is that you can then take that leading order rescaling and apply it to whatever very precise version, you know, the most precise molecular wave functions that you can write down, you can take that leading order rescaling and apply it there, and it should work the same way. To get all the way to cooling, we need to know not only what are all of the molecular energy levels and transition rates, we also need to know populations, we need to know how to do scattering, right? Because we need to know for any given ball of gas, what's the population of all the possible species that we can have, right, bound states and unbound states, and we need to then be able to interact them via scattering to evolve those populations. This is not simple. I think maybe right after me, we're gonna hear a talk that's a beautifully simple structure. This is not simple. The advantage, of course, is that it has a limit where it's known physics that's been very well tested in a lot of regimes. So again, this is James and Michael's really great work, where what we've done is say, well, given a cross-section, we're gonna tell you the overall leading order dependence on these parameters, so you can rescale them with some coefficient. And then to tell you the temperature dependence, we're gonna identify the leading order energy scale in the problem so that you rescale the energy, the temperature by that leading energy scale. And then that gives you leading order, you know, first order rate for the dark matter model. What we did here is just pull out that as a power law in B. Of course, you can just take this rescaling here and rescaling of the temperature again and put it into your favorite most precise set of reaction rates for the known for the standard model. And by doing that, we were able to obtain the cooling curves for a number of models in this parameter space. So this is, you know, the heavy fermion, the light fermion, the fine structure constant, and actually an important term, the fraction of molecular hydrogen, cosmologically. Okay, so that was a lot of work, and what we've been trying to do with that is now to put that stuff to work. So we have a number of numerical packages, basically. We've got something that James worked on to sort of figure out the cosmology of the early universe. We've got something that Michael worked on, which is to take a known chemistry solver, chrome, put in all these dark processes properly rescaled to have dark chrome so that we can evolve this chemistry network. And we've done sort of first pass analysis of using these results to give you something about the lowest temperature the gas can reach and the limit on the resulting mass of compact objects. What we've been doing since then is to go to the next level. And this again is because that compact objects, right, that's a hard problem. It's really easy to also speculate, which is why I stuck visible in my title, that this dissipative dark matter has many, many, many effects on the visible matter out there, right? Thanks. You know, for one thing, I told you about black holes made of dark matter. You say, well, why don't you have a mixture of dark matter and baryons? You have this cold gas, it's probably accreting, right? If you have this dissipative dark matter, there are all kinds of ways it's gonna affect the visible structure as well. So the way to get at this, to really do proper dissipative simulations, is to do proper dissipative simulations. So what we've done is to start to couple the chemistry that we know into a simulation structure that exists that's capable of doing the proper hydrodynamics. So we've been using Gizmo for that, with James's initial conditions and Michael's dark chrome. And the thing that we also need to do that's sort of new is to add the proper flexibility to go between what is the actual hydrodynamical regime of this gas back out to something that looks like N-body or the standard self-interacting dark matter treatment. And we'd like to do this in such a way that, you know, we're not tied to this particular model, which is the dark atomic dark matter model, but we can do it for other a wider variety of dissipative scenarios. So there's been some nice work, which I think we're also going to hear about from Caleb, maybe, by this group, including Phil, Norm Murray, David Curtin, Ryan Gelishante, and some great graduate students, where they take a small fraction of the dark matter and make it atomic dark matter to really study the effects sort of on the what's happening in the interior regions of the halos. We'd like to be able to do 100% dissipative dark matter so we can go all the way to that truly dissipative regime. And so we've been focused on this problem here at the bottom. So I'm going to tell you just a little bit about that. So you're probably familiar with the fact that for many years, people have been doing things like ADM in the context of the elastic scattering limit. So take all of these processes and in the limit where you know you have sort of you know, not too much dark matter, you can use for a large part of the simulation, it's valid to use this elastic limit. This is a plot from one of Francis Yan's papers, an early ETHOS paper, where they basically took a fitting function to what is the elastic cross-section for atomic dark matter. And they used some points that are velocity averaged in certain bins that give them a velocity-dependent self-interacting dark matter cross-section. And they could put that into the ETHOS framework and do some simulations. So that's basically a perturbation on N-body, right? It's sort of like you have your dark matter particles, and what you do is you let them exchange energy, right, according to how much energy you think they should be able to exchange with the appropriate you know, averages over velocity and angle. It's a perturbation on N-body. But of course, this stuff does have a hydrodynamic regime. And here, this is really work that's been led by our postdoc, Sarah Schoen. She should be here, but for visa issues, I'm going to do my best to represent her work. It's been great work. So let me tell you a little bit about it. So what Sarah's been doing is saying, well, how do we know if we're in the hydrodynamic regime? Well, the thing to do is look at how many scatters happen within basically a cell size of this gas. So what is the mean free path, right, which depends on the cross-section, depends on the density, compared to the physical scale in the simulation, which in this case is basically the size of the cell, the gas cell. If there are many, 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 many scatterers within that gas cell, then you're in the hydro regime. If there are not, then you're not. So in other words, we can ask what is the size of this Knudsen number and use that to tell us which regime we're actually in. So if you take a couple examples, three examples here, of that elastic limit cross-section for atomic dark matter, that's the blue, the orange, and the green, and just to orient you, this is velocity down here, going up to about 100 kilometers per second. So the strongest constraints you hear are about 1,000 kilometers per second, right? So over here off the chart, where you know that sigma over m needs to be below about 1 there. Oh, and I thought you plotted sigma over m. It's actually just sigma. No, it must be sigma over m. Sorry, there's over grams there. So that one line is where you know you would expect things to be constrained below. There are hints from smaller scale structure, various things, that actually you kind of want in this regime, more like 10 or 100, you may actually benefit in terms of structure from having a cross-section that's a little higher. So these, I think, are all things that are roughly consistent with the picture that you'd want today. So you consider those models, take a 10 to the 8 solar mass halo, and ask where in this simulation volume those particles are in the N-body regime clearly, where they're in sort of like a mid-territory, where it's maybe not clear, and where they're in the hydro regime. So that's what she's done here by basically computing the density and the velocity profile of the halo. Right. With the density and velocity profile, you can figure out what your mean free path is. You can compare it to your cell volume size that we're using here, and you can ask, you know, are they in the n-body regime? They should be, right? We know everything should be on the outskirts of the halo. We're not consistent with current data. And where do they cross into the fluid regime? Here below, sort of sub-parsec scales for the examples considered here. So then you know what, you know, where you need to worry about this transition.
And that was a 5, not a 1.
Oh, okay. You're like, you're done. This is crap. Okay. Yeah. It's such power. Okay. So what Sarah proposed is that we basically introduce a smoothing function. And the smoothing function is going to depend on whether we're in the, you know, small Knudsen number regime or not. So here she's got it as a function of critical density, and you have some power for how fast it falls off. So this is a smoothing function that is going to help us transition between hydrodynamics and n-body, or SIDM. And what you do then is you basically, you know, have this, you paste in an intermediate regime where you're just going to take some fraction of, you're going to weight some part of the kinetic regime solution, some part of the hydro regime solution, and that's going to allow you to sort of paste together these two regimes. So this is something that Sarah came up with, and then actually we learned that this is something that's been done in previous literature where people, this was like planes entering the atmosphere or something, where people have, you know, this is not a problem that's unique to cosmology, obviously, going between the hydro regime and the kinetic regime. So this is something that's been tested in other contexts, and it basically prevents you from having a sharp boundary, right, where you have to do matching across the boundary of these two regimes. You have this intermediate scaling regime. So what happens? Well, so I have for you a few examples of what happens. These are Sarah's simulations. And in the first slide, what she's doing is comparing an n-body simulation. The great thing about Gizmo, let me say, is that we can do n-body, we can do SIDM, SIDM with dissipation, and we can do a variety of approaches to the hydrodynamics. So in this case, we're comparing what happens in the n-body simulation. Now this is a 10 to the 6 solar mass halo. To what happens in a sort of a simple case, we're not going to worry about cooling, in this scheme she has to interpolate out to, you know, from hydro out to n-body or to SIDM. And this is just an illustration that you're seeing on large scales that it's working, right? She's getting the limit going back to n-body correct in this case. On the other hand, you can now say, well, how much does this get us what we know happens in self-interacting dark matter, right? So this is a comparison of versions of ADM, again, without the detailed cooling, right? It's still hydro. It still has sort of, it has internal energy that can eat kinetic energy. And self-interacting dark matter. Self-interacting dark matter models are in terms of sort of where is that flat part and where is the fall off. So the V naught is where is the fall off, and the sigma MT is the sort of the momentum transfer cross-section on the plateau. And as we go this way, that's becoming weaker and weaker and weaker. So weaker interaction. And what you can see, is that right, actually? I guess that looks backwards, doesn't it? Yeah, maybe that's backwards. Well, wait, no, sorry. But look here. This is low, this is high, this is lower. So this is actually, the cross-section is falling off as we go. So things are becoming, I guess, more less diffuse overall and more clumpy. So this is essentially illustrating that the sort of, what happens when you do this momentum transfer with a little bit of dissipation, actually, because you can actually dissipate some stuff in the SIDM model, it more or less looks like what's happening in this scheme where you go back toward hydro, right? In the regime where those particle interactions matter more.
Sarah, can you
Yes. Yeah, sorry. Yeah, I didn't explain. So this is the dissipative fraction. So sometimes you can run these SIDMs where you also dissipate energy. And you might think that that's a good idea for comparison just because you do have some of that kinetic energy being eaten to internal energy in the hydro. Yeah. Too many parameters. Yeah. This is how fast it falls off, which is something we're sort of trying to figure out what the right thing to do is there. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, let me pause there. Any other questions? Because there's a lot on here that I'm probably not explaining carefully.
How do you decide on that output?
Yeah, for the moment we're exploring because, you know, basically where do you get good behavior? Where do you not introduce weird artifacts, you know, how fast it falls off? Yeah, how fast you, so you have some function which depends on the density compared to the critical density, and that's going to transition you between the hydro and the kinetic, and how steep, how sharp of a fall off do you make that?
Is there a limit that you can take where things can be done by things?
Which things do you want to?
Well, so I'm used to thinking of this in a different context where you have a Boltzmann equation, and you can solve it in one of the limits, but not in the middle, and that's what you need. interpolating functions?
I think here, because this is what happens in this sort of pasted in regime between the hydro and the kinetic, you're kind of allowed to tune that parameter whatever you want. You only know it has to be between 0 and 1 on the edges.
So right, I don't, on the edges you should reproduce.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, and I think for, okay, so good. So in the limit, of course, depending on the size of this region, we can do whatever we want. And by construction, this solution is designed to match the solutions on the boundaries of that region because it's just a linear combination of those.
Can you explain the progression from left to right on this response?
Oh, this I think is actually just a time progression. Okay. Yeah, sorry, I didn't say that. Yeah, it's just what happens, how does the halo form? Okay.
This is my fault.
Yes. Okay. No, that's good. That's fine. Good. I'm about done with the slides I want to show. So then the other thing you can do is you can ask what happens really in the dense center. So remember what she showed for these particular plots is that it's really only, this is 10 to the 3 times, it's only in this small region. It's in the interior region where you're really going to see the effects, you know, of treating this hydro regime properly. So this is sort of a picture of what happens, what looks different when you have a, you know, not very strong atomic dark matter model, but one that's going to change the interior. They actually look remarkably the same, but again, this is, you know, part of the point of this slide is you have to really do a zoom in order to see what's happening in that very central region, right? Because like cooling is going to be operative right in there. This is also, I should say, approximate cooling. This is a standard model cooling, so it's not same. So what she's doing now, what we're doing now is basically to do those zoom ins to try to treat the interior of this structure correctly. And you know, preliminary results basically show that with a higher resolution, you can see that what's happening in the center sort of agrees with what you expect. But that's the piece we need to do. Okay, so that's good. So then I think what I'll do is I'll stop. But basically the two points I want to pass, I think for this audience, it's maybe not a surprise. There's a big opportunity in terms of compact object formation. As a way to really get out what is the dark matter model and what are its microphysics. And that's it. There's an easy, very straightforward way to limit dark fermion masses. You can start to do things, more interesting things like total cooling rates. And you can also potentially get at whatever is the physics that's telling you that lowest cooling limit. And I think we'll hear in various models what that looks like today. I think really to understand what this does, I don't know. I think we have to do simulations, right? I think you even look back at the history of self-interacting dark matter. People had lots of predictions for how things were going to go. Even with self-interacting dark matter, where you're doing this pretty simple exchange of energy, the simulations showed that results were different from the basic prediction. So I don't trust myself to make predictions with this until we at least have some grounding in some simulation technology. And so that's what we're working for. And I think this ultimately, you know, will open up a whole new world of dissipative dark matter structure formation modeling when we can do proper hydrodynamical simulations. OK, I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thanks a lot. So we've engineered plenty of time for questions.
First of all, thanks for a very nice overview of a very interesting subject over the last few years. So I'm curious about whether the cross sections that you folks are examining for direct collapse, if you look at what that does to massive black holes. So people thought about this. Dark matter is a way to get seed masses right. Basically, you should have a similar effect there, right? Is there kind of a direct connection between these two regimes, or is it just totally different processes?
I don't think it needs, and again, this is actually something Sarah would be great to answer because she's thought a lot more about the various regimes. I don't think it necessarily needs to be completely different. And part of the reason is this. I didn't show the plots of the various, you know, how dependent on the mass of the halo and the parameters, things cool. But obviously, the limit you can cool to is different depending on the details of the halo itself. So while some regions may cool to the lowest limit, and then you get these objects that are very small, you may have cooling that's a little less operative in other regions, and then you may see things that are a little bigger. So I don't know is the short answer, but I don't think that it's necessarily disjoint, which is really interesting. So I don't know. Maybe you know. No.
I think I've got a problem for doing here something I'm trying to do lately. It's about like this, you know, like galaxies is drawn. And so, kind of like, pretty much it's an astral thing that aren't, but we're not in the business of doing the job for the astronomer people. So, now that you have like this like N-body, have you thought about like, oh, like, can we form this like funny early galaxy that or that?
Yeah, I mean, I guess here again, you know, I'm a theorist, I don't have a lot of humility, but I do have humility in this because people work really hard to try to get this right in the standard model and they don't agree necessarily.
Yeah.
So I doubt that I'm going to say something that's actually compelling at this point in what we know, you know, both from the simulation side and what we know from observation. But yeah, this is one of those things where, again, you just expect that a model like this is going to change some about structure formation. Now, disentangling what that is, especially on these complicated scales, I don't know for sure. But yeah, sure.
A little bit is okay. You need dissipation to have like this. Maybe you can enhance like star formation, and you cannot have very large structure. So
yeah.
I don't know. You start to check all these interesting things, and
yeah, I think
something interesting about
it's tantalizing. I wouldn't trust any conclusion that I drew at this point in time, but it's something to do. Yeah. Yeah, and actually, I look forward to hearing from you all on this because maybe there are things I haven't thought of.
Yes. Being able to get some constraints based on the black holes that these create merging. I was wondering how you were estimating those merger rates, because I know these primordial black holes, it's kind of boring.
Yeah, so what we did is we, again, basically used what's been done in POP3 star literature. So we went from the fragmentation scale, we estimated how to rescale the fragmentation scale in the gas, and then we used, there are plenty of holes you can poke in this method, but what we did is we used what's known in simulations of POP3 stars about the number of binaries that typically form, what a binary separation is in those models, and we use sort of standard distributions for eccentricities and things like that, and then we plug that into Peter's formula and ran the thing. So I think in some ways it's a little bit less of an issue because unlike primordial black holes, you know, these things are forming in a way that's familiar from astrophysics. And so we don't have quite as much freedom, I think, in what we do. I mean, it's still uncertain, but at least we know what the sort of rails that we should stay within.
Yeah, they're already forming kind of overdense patches, so they're a more tightly packed.
Yes, yeah, exactly. You know, and basically, the biggest uncertainty, I think, in what we did in terms of rates, there are two, actually, I should say, to be, you know, for full disclosure. One is just what is the fraction of this dark matter in dark black holes? I don't know. In some sense, that's what the data is telling me. It's constraining that fraction for me. And the other thing actually is what is the initial binary separation? Because there's a really big dependence on when things merge based on that binary separation. And that we did, again, as some rescaling from those simulations, but this stuff is all, you know, super high resolution. These things are really close together. So whether that kind of rescaling is correct, I don't know. And that's a big caveat in those rates as well. You know, on that note, you can look at microlensing, right, as an alternative. And so we are doing that as well because you put those two things together and you get away from some of these merger rate issues.
So, actually, just to comment on that point, so you mentioned the fragmentation scale. So it really, although the understanding of it is setting the gamma on one side of the mass, the fragmentation scale is actually setting the typical size of the black holes you get, right? So is there, you really have to try to play to get the fragmentation scale, the mass within the fragmentation volume to be below, you know, solar mass, right? Is that the right thing to play here?
Yeah. And I think what we showed, and James is the expert on this in terms of these sort of, you know, like one zone models, which should sort of bound the behavior. What we're able to show is that given the cooling rate we're reaching in those models, the fragmentation scale is, in fact, typically below the Chandrasekhar limit before you have the effect of sort of accretion, which in POP3 stars at least is a big factor that increases the size of those objects that may cause them then to be black holes. But they're still actually subsolar from the Chandrasekhar limit in that. But yeah, that's a whole parameter space to understand.
And do you have a sense of how much of the dark matter ends up in some kind of structure, whether it's a glass black hole or not?
Right. So one of the estimates that we've done, and I think we can pull up these plots if you want, and again, this is James's work, right, is to say, given these cooling rates and these one-zone simulations, you can take the initial mass function, and you can ask what part of that mass function is actually in the regime that can cool in the dynamical timescale of those objects. And it can be a pretty narrow window. So you only have, you know, sort of around maybe the peak a little down the side of the mass function is typically in a cooling regime. But then, you know, when you say how much of that is in structures, that's the total mass in those halos. But then, you know, obviously a lot of that sort of acts like n-body stuff and there's just structure in the center. So I don't have a really good answer for you, but in principle, if you knew how to integrate up all those things and you trusted your you know, your merger trees and whatever, you could have a precise answer for that question.
So you have a few free parameters in the microphysics model. Like, are all of them important, or do they wind up being degenerate? So you have your immediate mass, your mass, or your little particle mass, your big particle mass.
Yeah, they all matter in various combinations. I don't know that we never did make a proper plot that showed the various ways to combine those parameters into the meaning, physically meaningful versions, but do you want to say anything?
I mean, like, when you're not thinking about the molecular physics, it's a little bit easier because you just have one energy scale from the atomic transitions. When you start thinking about molecular cooling, then you have vibrational and rotational transitions that scale in different ways with the different combinations of the parameters.
So, like, how sensitive are you? How can you cover that practice? In what sense do you mean?
Well, like do very small changes give you your spectrum, give you large effects on
I guess I'm still not sure how to answer that question. I mean, you know, like sure, like you could phrase some, like depending what you're interested in, you could like phrase this in terms of like the minimum molecular energy gap, and you know, maybe for some things that would be the relevant combination of parameters, right? There's not like exquisitely sensitive dependencies, I would say. Like everything is just like power laws, right?
Like, I guess we didn't find like weird discontinuities in the parameter space where all of a sudden, you know, we didn't find like special points, but if that's what you mean.
That was going to be my question too, because when you're going to have these parameters, like getting, you're going to have the whole thing. It's going to be very expensive and very time consuming. It's like you have to think very well about which parameters, because how do you have the power to do a bunch of things? Like, you know,
good. Well, I think to give you an estimate, good, thanks. You know, these simulation results that I'm showing here are actually things that can be basically done on a laptop.
Okay.
So to make sure that you're not breaking things egregiously on large scales, that's easy.
Okay.
But then to actually go and get that resolution and what's the molecular cooling and all, that's expensive.
You don't have baryons here, I guess. So
yeah, in principle, you do want to add the baryons, right? Right.
We don't add the
exactly. But at least to decide, am I breaking things egregiously,
exactly.
You can do that inexpensively.
But I guess people
and then,
every day, then
yes, that's right. That's right.
How unrealistic is it to throw this into an MCMC?
I don't know. I mean, we've certainly done that on like the black hole modeling side. So how we combine? Yeah, I don't know. That's an interesting question.
What sets the dark matter abundance? These processes.
Yeah. So I guess my operating procedure on this has been there are lots of questions about where various things come from in the early universe, including like baryogenesis, that I don't know the answer to. So I'm actually not going to worry about that. I'm going to worry about what's consistent with the...
So this is agnostic to dark matter?
It's agnostic. Now, there are lots of issues you may have. For example, this dark matter is very cold. You might ask, how realistic that I reheat that way? You know, there are lots of good questions you can ask there, but we've been agnostic about that feature.
In principle, that would slice the fracture space.
It would, yeah. But again, my humility about my being able to come up with the correct model, I don't know. So we're going to go the other way. But yeah, it's a great question.
Time to move on. So thanks again.